From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we talk with Barbara McQuaid, the newly fired U.S. attorney for Michigan's Eastern District.
Would have liked a little more notice time to try to wind things down and have an orderly transition, but that's the way it goes, and I'll do my best to make sure that the office will continue to be successful.
Giving Latino-owned businesses a jump start in West Michigan.
A lot of businesses, Latino or non-Latino, they fail within the first year, but it's a little more pervasive in the Latino community.
Rough winter duty aboard the Coast Guard's only heavy icebreaker on the Great Lakes.
As the ship passes through that pressurized ice, it causes violent vibrations. It really does shake the entire ship as the ice kind of grinds against the hull.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up this hour, why researchers believe excluding inmates from Medicaid is driving up costs and hurting inmates' health.
Having that benefit removed while you're incarcerated can really impact the care you receive while you're pregnant.
And much more. But first, 46 U.S. attorneys appointed by President Obama are clearing out their desks today after Friday's abrupt demand from Attorney General Jeff Sessions for their resignations. Among those asked to resign, the first woman to serve as U.S. attorney for the Eastern District here in Michigan, Barbara McQuaid, was appointed by President Obama in January 2010. And she is with us now. This happened so late Friday, Barbara, that reportedly there were some U.S. attorneys who didn't even know they'd been fired until they woke up Saturday morning. How and when did you learn the news?
Well, a press release was issued about 3 o'clock, but I got a call at about 4:15 asking me to submit my resignation. And it was a little unclear at that time whether it was immediate, but it was later made clear that it was.
What were your first thoughts?
I certainly expected that I would be leaving at some point in the coming months. But in January, we've been asked to hold over to ensure an orderly transition. So I was a little surprised it was so abrupt and so sudden. But certainly I think most of us were planning to move on at some point. It is customary for new presidents to appoint new U.S. attorneys.
And knowing that you do serve at the pleasure of the president, what have you been doing to prepare for your departure since Donald Trump's election?
Trying to transition things and make sure that our programs are in good shape here, that we have people ready to lead. So we certainly have been transitioning over the past several months since the election. So we're actually pretty well prepared to do it. But, it's not the kind of job that you can leave on a moment's notice. So, I'm at the office today trying to help others to be prepared to do their jobs, to hand off things in an orderly fashion. I imagine I'll need to continue to do that for at least the next several days.
So that's kind of your plan is to by the end of the – when do you plan to be gone?
Well, I don't know, as long as it takes. I have plenty of time. So, I'll go through our cases, go through our projects, go through upcoming events and make sure that they're all covered and handled.
Barbara, CNN and The Washington Post are both reporting that the attorney general had a big conference call with all 93 U.S. attorneys Wednesday, kind of a pep talk, it's reported, and that there was no hint that anyone's job was about to be eliminated. Is that the impression that you got from that call?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think this came from Attorney General Sessions. I mean, the message was that it had come from President Trump. So I don't know whether he knew at the time, but it didn't seem that he did.
So that was, the report is correct, it was kind of a pep talk and it was about working together with the Attorney General?
Yeah.
Okay. How would you have preferred this to be handled?
It's not up to me. And different presidents do it in different ways. It was done this way in the Clinton administration and I think roundly criticized in the last two administrations. People permitted to leave as their successors were identified. And that seems like a more orderly way to do things. But, certainly the president is permitted to have in these offices whoever he wants or doesn't want. And so, it's his prerogative. Would have liked a little more notice time to try to wind things down and have an orderly transition. But that's the way it goes. And I'll do my best to make sure that the office will continue to be successful.
And who's in charge now on the interim basis?
There is an acting U.S. attorney. He has until now been the first assistant U.S. attorney. His name is Dan Lemish. He is a longtime career prosecutor here, a tremendous lawyer and a tremendous public servant, and I take great comfort in knowing that he'll be running the office until a new U.S. attorney is nominated.
And we've noted this administration has been kind of slow to place presidential appointments to date. Should it take some time for your replacement to come in, what do you think could be lost when there is not a permanent person in charge?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm hopeful that our very capable first assistant will do a fine job. We've got 115 lawyers here, all in the middle of cases, and I know they'll continue to see those cases through. So, you know, it's a feeling. I've been through these transitions before as an assistant U.S. attorney. There's always a little bit of uncertainty until the U.S. attorney is named. But I have confidence in the people who work here that they'll continue to work hard with great professionalism until that time comes.
Barbara McQuaid, let's talk about what you've done in your time as the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District. What are the cases that really stand out for you?
Well, there's a number of them. You know, some of the things I'm most proud of is the work that we've done in civil rights. We've had two cases resolved fairly recently, one permitting the building of an Islamic school in Pittsfield Township and another permitting the building of a mosque in Sterling Heights. After both of those institutions were denied permission to build in those communities, we filed lawsuits under the religious land use statutes and were able to obtain a settlement to get them to reverse those decisions. So I'm very proud of that work so that those institutions can be built in those communities. I'm certainly proud of the public corruption work that we've done, from prosecuting former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick to the public officials in Macomb County who've been charged recently, and the Detroit Public School principals charged with bribery. And then we had a very significant case against the underwear bomber. On my first day on the job, the Al-Qaeda operative who tried to blow up a plane over Detroit on Christmas Day in 2009. So there have been a lot of cases, and thanks to the great work of the men and women who work in this office, we've seen a lot of success that I hope has improved the quality of life for the people who live in our community.
You put a lot of effort into community engagement, particularly with the Muslim community. How would you characterize that relationship between the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District and the community?
Well, I hope it is strong. It's something that we care very much about. I think people think of us mostly for our enforcement work, but that's really only a portion of what we do. We also try to do a lot of prevention work and prevent crimes from occurring in the first place. And the way to do that is by engaging with the community and talking to people so that when they have information to share with you about tips or leads, they are confident that you're going to do the right thing with it. So we spend a lot of time engaging with a lot of different communities throughout our district, and the Muslim and Arab community is one of them. And it's important that they feel like I'm their U.S. attorney, too.
Now, talking about ongoing investigations and lawsuits, one of the important things ongoing is the suit that your office filed in East Point, arguing that the city's electoral process violates the Voting Rights Act. The city's about one-third black, but no African-American resident has held local office there. What do you expect to happen to that lawsuit?
Well, we'll see. We always try to resolve lawsuits. I think it's better to resolve lawsuits than, one, spending the resources and going to court, two, risking the uncertainty of going to court, and three, you get a when people agree to an outcome, they're more likely to accept it and embrace it. So we'll pursue settlement, but if not, we're prepared to go to trial. And our thought was, let's get this done before the next election cycle.
And in your view, how much of a bellwether is this East Point case to see just where the Jeff Sessions-led Justice Department lies on voting rights issues?
I don't know, but this lawsuit was filed during the Obama administration, but the current administration has certainly permitted it to go forward. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get our day in court or at least reach a settlement in this case.
What are the major challenges that, in your mind, await your successor? I guess if you were going to have an exit interview, what would you say are the priorities moving forward?
Well, I would certainly urge any successor to continue to engage with our communities. That's so critically important, I think, to make sure you're out there listening and understanding the needs of the community from all components of the community. I certainly would talk about violent crime. We have violent crime challenges in Detroit and Flint and Pontiac and Saginaw and other parts of our district. And everybody who lives in those communities deserve the same high quality of life as everyone else. We've put together some very good partnerships with law enforcement agencies in those communities. I would love to see that to continue and to grow. So I would certainly urge them to consider some of those strategies that we found to be successful and hope to build on.
I'm wondering, do you have any regrets as you leave? I mean, in terms of, let's say, public corruption, is there any issue or instance that you feel like you weren't able to get to it?
Well, there's always, you know, more work than you can possibly get to. We have to prioritize our cases. We have to try to, you know, go after the cases that we feel are the most significant. So you can't always get to all of them. But I really feel like I have no regrets. I have poured every ounce of energy and every part of my soul into this job. And I am proud of the work that we've done here together.
What are your thoughts about this new administration and the new attorney general?
I wish them all the best. You know, all of our country needs them to administer justice fairly, and I'm hopeful that that's what they'll do.
Was there a moment in your time as a U.S. attorney when it really hit you that the awesome power that a U.S. attorney has at their disposal?
Well, there were many instances. The cases that we recently brought against some of the largest automaker and auto supplier in the world, we had a case against Volkswagen that cheated on the EPA emissions tests at the lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we brought charges against them and resolved it for a $4.3 billion fine. That felt like, you know, a tremendous opportunity to use power to right wrongs. Same with Takata and their airbags. You know, they had the exploding airbags that resulted in 16 deaths and hundreds of injuries, and we were able to bring a criminal case against them, resulting in a criminal conviction and a $1 billion fine. So all of those things certainly make you realize the tremendous ability that we have to do good.
I know it's early, but have you started shaping plans for the future?
Yes, I do have thoughts. You know, although the timing of the announcement Friday was unexpected, the fact of it was not. And so I had been planning to leave in the coming months anyway. And so I do have some plans. I'm not quite prepared to announce them today, but sometime in the coming days, I will be announcing that.
We'll look forward to hearing that. Barbara McQuaid, okay. The outgoing U.S. attorney for the Eastern District in Michigan. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Up next, breaking down barriers keeping Latino businesses scarce in West Michigan.
Ask those entrepreneurs, those who are would-be entrepreneurs and already established business owners, what is it that they need?
Plus, Michigan is the new Big Ten champs. John Eubacon breaks down that win and more. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. And how do we count the ways that the cards were stacked against the Michigan Wolverines? And yet they did it. They beat Wisconsin and became the Big Ten champions.
This will go down as one of the greatest stories in Michigan basketball history. I'm not even kidding. They're 8th seed out of 14 going in. That's not good.
No.
Now they're on a roll, I grant you, but nonetheless, that you're not supposed to win, go very far with that, of course. Wednesday, what has to be called a plane accident. And it didn't just run past the runway. The plane tried to take off. The winds on Wednesday, you might recall them, 60 miles an hour. Not a good idea. Brings it back down to the runway, crashes through the fence, over a ditch. The landing gear's busted. The plane won't be flying maybe ever again. And that's
shook them up.
It should have, only if you're paying attention. And here's the cool part. John Beilein was the last man to leave that plane. That's old school Titanic stuff, of course.
Yes.
And the players noticed that. And then he very wisely asked the players, look, they tried to get the Big Ten to move the game the next day, a noon game, crazy. They wouldn't do it. Shame on the Big Ten. So they had to take a 7 o'clock flight the next morning, which means you're getting up at 4 o'clock to do all this. And he asked the players, look, there are bigger things than a basketball game. If you want to forfeit it and not get on a plane again after this thing 24 hours earlier, I understand. It's up to you guys entirely. No pressure. The players, of course, voted to play the game, but their love for Beilein, last man off the plane, and giving them the option to play or not play, you could see it the next day. I mean, they got 4 hours of sleep, and they ripped through the Big Ten schedule. Amazing work. They beat the top two teams, Purdue and Wisconsin, along the way. And that's one of the best stories in Michigan basketball history.
Am I correct? Derek Walton kind of banged his knee up in that kind of weird plane accident?
Which tells you again, it wasn't just them running past the runway.
Yes.
I've done that. You've probably done that. Yeah. It's not fun, but it's not the same thing as this. No, they basically crashed. Lucky crash, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Two guys deserve credit. Beilein for the job he's done the last 2 months. And Derek Walton Jr. has put this team on his back. He has put in one of the greatest performances this second half of the season I have ever seen in Michigan basketball.
That is something. And now the big dance gets underway for Michigan, number 7 seed in the Midwest region. Your thoughts on that position?
They got screwed.
Okay.
After all that, there you go. They've got Oklahoma State starting out, all offense, no defense. They should probably win that game. If they win that game, almost certainly they're playing number two seeded Louisville, mm-hmm. a very good team. There are no breaks there for Michigan.
No breaks there.
Having said that, what have they not faced?
Yeah, look what just happened.
If the flight is safe, you're already ahead of the game.
Tom Izzo heads to the NCAA tournament with his Spartans for the 20th straight time. Things are a little different than they were a year ago when they were one of the top two favorites to win it all and then got blown out by Middle Tennessee. That was the biggest upset in NCAA tournament history.
That's probably true.
Wow. Well, this time around, they're a number nine seed.
This is almost a better place to be. They have nothing to lose. Last year's team was supposed to go big. Obviously, they did not. This year's team, you've got three freshmen are your best players. Well, what happens with three freshmen? They grow up fast and never bet against an Izzo team in March.
You say that a lot.
And I'm usually right except for last year. Gloriously wrong last year. But freshmen have a way of growing up. They've gotten the playing time this year. They've also got, you know, the next game won't be any easier. But nothing to lose. Don't bet against them.
And then so when they play Friday night, number 8 seed Miami, Florida in Tulsa, what do they need? What's Izzo need to get out of these kids?
Stay calm. Mm. Stay calm. They're freshmen. First time at the big dance. Just do your game.
And not to put the cart before the horse, but let's do it. If the Spartans get past Miami, they will likely face number 1 seeded Kansas on Sunday.
My advice there is the opposite. Go crazy. You got nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose.
Press. You know, get your nose in there. Take fouls, whatever. Shoot like crazy. Be a team they don't want to play.
Any predictions at all as to who might be in the Final Four?
UNC, but that's the chicken's bet.
And that's as far as you're going.
That's as far as I'm going.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And as always, thanks, John.
Cindy, thank you.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities. The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
West Michigan's got a big Latino population, but few Latino-owned businesses. Ferris State University wants to change that with something called the Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative. Carlos Sanchez is director of the Latino Business and Economic Development Center at Ferris State. With us now, welcome to The Next Idea, Carlos.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why is it there are so few small Latino-owned businesses in West Michigan, especially when you consider the Latino population is higher than the state average, so certainly the customer base is there?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of things. One is, of course, barriers, right? Sometimes it's funding, meaning access to capital. And the other is the natural attrition, if you will, of businesses. We know that I think a lot of businesses, normally Latino or non-Latino, they fail within the first year. But it's a little more pervasive in the Latino community and other minority communities, but we're talking about the Latino community. It's a little bit more pervasive because of sometimes knowledge, the lack of knowledge of the business, or the lack of knowledge of the customer. So that is what we are trying to help with this initiative.
And how will the initiative address these issues? What kind of form will it take?
Sure. We are using a curriculum that was created by an organization in Chattanooga. We got it from CoStarters, and we are partnering with Spring ER here in Grand Rapids. And what we do is we boil it down to the basics, right? We ask the individual to identify a need in the community and the actual customer that they're looking at, rather than saying, well, everybody's my customer and everybody likes what I do, to focus on that exact customer and to create a solution for a need or for a problem that exists in the community that they can make a business out of it. The other piece that we want to do is to help individuals start their business right away. I'll give you an example. Sometimes someone might say, well, I want to start a restaurant because I make really good, tamales, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? So from having one dish, a really good dish, to a restaurant, there's a lot of stuff in between. So sometimes that creates a barrier because few people have $40,000, $50,000 to start a business. But we tell them, why don't you start just a little bit of a catering that you can do only need, you know, $500, maybe $1,000 to start. So that gets them to start making money, let's say, right away.
So you're giving them advice and guidance and helping them kind of go through the proper stages. You know, you got to crawl before you walk.
That is correct. Yeah, we tell them, first of all, you know, to frame their idea, And then we gradually we take them through that, developing a name for their business, what is their business, a little bit of finance, a little bit of marketing. And we use, rather than prepare them to write a business plan, we work with what's called the business canvas. It's a bit more visual tool that is easier to grasp. And then if they need a business plan or when they need a business plan, they just can basically download all that information into a formal business plan.
I found it very interesting, Carlos Sanchez, that as you move ahead with the Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative, this is less about those tech-type startups that seem to consume all the oxygen in the room when we talk about the entrepreneur community. You want people to think about lifestyle businesses. You mentioned, for example, making food. So what are some other examples of these kind of businesses?
Sure. Well, the thing is, you're absolutely right. We are focusing on lifestyle businesses because those are the businesses that are starting almost every week, if not every day, right? These individuals, these entrepreneurs are going to start a business no matter what. So we want to help them. We know that there's another ecosystem out there that is supporting technology, high tech, high growth, and that's fine. We are trying to foster this other ecosystem. So aside from food is, for example, barbershops or hair salons, sometimes some other type of services, construction, painting, framing, siding, things like that. Those folks are already doing it sometimes, you know, working for someone, and they decide, I can do this for myself. Why don't I go in, as we say, hang on my own shingle, right?
Yeah. Now, how is what you're doing through the Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative, how is this different, for example, than taking a business class at a college?
It is a little bit different because first, we also emphasize the peer-to-peer support. Sometimes people are a little bit afraid of going into the marketing area of the business or finance or, you know, the accounting. This is a little bit less formal, but very well structured.
And very practical, it seems.
Well, that is correct, yes.
Yeah, I was also struck with the fact you're building the hours for these workshops and courses around working people who have jobs and who have families, and also classes are going to be largely in Spanish.
Absolutely. You know, the past couple of programs, we realized that there was a need. Also utilizing that very entrepreneurial mindset, we saw the need in the community for a curriculum in Spanish. So now we're teaching it in Spanish. And of course, yes, we look at what are the best times for them to attend these classes. So we're doing it from 6 to 9 p.m. We provide childcare if needed, and also we provide them with dinner. So we are trying to, again, to minimize those barriers for the individual, language, childcare, food, you name it. And we also provide those classes. We are facilitating those classes at the Hispanic Center, which is a place that's well known in the community and also placed in the heart of the Latino community.
Carlos, if other institutions might be thinking about trying to boost Latino business ownership, what would be your advice to them if they were to start their own initiatives? What's most important?
To do some research in the community, what is needed. And so ask those entrepreneurs, those who are would-be entrepreneurs and already established business owners, what is it that they need? Because what might work here in Grand Rapids might not work in Lansing or in Saginaw. I can tell you that right now we are one of 5 pilot programs in the country that are utilizing the same curriculum, and we are constantly in communication, and we are finding that what works in Texas doesn't work in Chattanooga or doesn't work here in Michigan, but there are other things that do work. So what I would advise them is, again, you know, find a group of advisors, right, would-be entrepreneurs and already established businesses, to find out exactly what are the needs of the community in that location.
Carlos, how will you measure the success of the Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative?
Well, that piece is a little bit tricky. Let me tell you, the easiest way will be to measure the number of businesses that are created. But the fact is that some people, not everybody, is ready to be an entrepreneur. So we also want to measure those that went through our program but decided not to, but we ask, why not? Some might say, well, I realize that, no, this is not for me. I really need to work for someone. That we will consider also a success because that person is not, quote unquote, wasting time and money and effort in a venture that he or she might not really want it at all. So we are trying to devise right now what are our measurements of success? Yes, one would be the number of businesses that are launched, but also the level of entrepreneurial IQ, if you will, that we are developing in the community. The number of applicants for our next cohort in the fall, that will also be a measure of success. That means that, people want and do this. And we are also developing other measures.
You can find out about the Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative by going to Ferris State University's website. It's the Latino Business and Economic Development Center. And Carlos Sanchez is director of that center. It was great to talk with you, and the best of luck with this initiative.
Thank you very much, and thank you for shining the light on this program.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
All right, hands up. Who's cried at work? Something happens, maybe a bad performance review or the boss barks at you, and before you can shut him down, here come the tears. What can you do to save face in front of supervisors or colleagues? A newly released study looks at crying on the job and how you might turn that into a positive. One of the researchers is here with us now. Julia Lee will soon be an assistant professor at the Ross School of Business. She is a postdoctoral fellow at U of M's Center for Positive Organizations. Julia, what did you find as far as what to do? Is there a right way to cry in front of the boss?
In our study, we found that people could say, "I'm so sorry that I just cried, but I was so passionate about this project or this particular promotion or this job that I had to express this negative feelings." And so if you attribute it to a passion, which could be more related to the work itself, rather than being emotional, which is typically attributed to yourself or your tendency to cry or something that is more innate. And so by attributing it to passion, we found that people perceive you as having more self-control, and people think that you are more competent than people who just cried or people who said that "I'm so sorry that I cried, I was being emotional."
So I'm reframing the moment then for the boss or for my coworkers.
Right, right. And that was really interesting because a lot of the work that I have done before and what the literature says was mostly about what you can do when there is an event that makes me feeling emotional, how do you regulate that? But what we found is that even if you were not able to regulate that and you kind of failed to do so in the moment, which is very common, obviously, you can still change or manage the effect of you crying in front of everyone by telling a story about that in a slightly different way.
Could one make a case that this is at its core kind of lying?
Yes, I think that was the main criticism. And I actually don't believe it would be a lying kind of a situation. And I actually value authenticity a lot more than managing impressions. And I'm just hoping that our workplace becomes much more compassionate and becomes much more accepting of exchanging real emotions and expressing true emotions in general. But I also don't think that it is lying or being inauthentic, especially if it is a situation that you can actually be passionate about something and something didn't work out for you.
So bottom line, you find yourself having a moment during your performance review. As tears spring to the eyes, what would your advice be?
So my advice would be to say that "I am so sorry that I just cried because I was so passionate about this promotion or the job that it really made me express these emotions."
Julia Lee, soon to be assistant professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. She was on the research team that published the paper, "Managing Perceptions of Distress at Work, Reframing Emotion as Passion." You'll find it in the November 2016 issue of Organizational Behavior and Human Decision Processes. Interesting stuff, Julia. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, winter duty aboard the Coast Guard ice cutter Mackinac.
It really does shake the entire ship as the ice kind of grinds against the hull. And there is a deafening, reverberating sound throughout the ship. And it can take a toll on the crew.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A key part of the Affordable Care Act was expanding Medicaid. In our state, it's known as Healthy Michigan, and it's meant health care coverage for over 600,000 people. But if you wind up in the criminal justice system, even if it's just pretrial detention and you're facing charges, Medicaid benefits turn off like the flip of a switch. University of Michigan researchers believe excluding inmates from Medicaid is driving up costs and hurting inmate health. Dr. Tyler Winkleman is one of those researchers, and he's with us now bringing a physician's perspective. Now, doctor, a criminal record does not disqualify someone from Medicaid, right?
That's correct. It only disqualifies you while you're currently incarcerated.
So prisoners cannot access Medicaid. And why is that?
When Medicaid was passed back in 1965, part of the language in the legislation prevented inmates from receiving any Medicaid payment while they were incarcerated. So this has been in place for several decades now.
What was the thinking behind that?
Two things. First, when Social Security was initially passed in 1935, this population was excluded. And because Medicaid was amended to the Social Security Act, that provision sort of made its way into Medicaid policy. And the other issue that people were concerned about was that if you provided health care benefits while someone was incarcerated, then you may have an incentive to lock people up to give them treatment rather than providing treatment while they're in the community.
So here we are, 2017, and we have it that unless an inmate is hospitalized for 24 hours or longer, who pays for their medical costs?
All of the health care costs while an individual is in jail is paid for by county governments, and all of the health care costs in state prison are paid for by the state government.
Do we have any idea what that price tag is?
Our most recent estimates are from 2011, and the total cost for people in prison was about $7.7 billion. The amount in jail is not known, but there are far more people in jail than there are in prison.
So we can kind of just estimate that it's a skyrocketing price tag as we see our prison populations go up. And if you look at the health of people who are involved in the justice system, people who are behind bars, how does it compare with the general population?
There's no doubt that individuals who are in jail or in prison have much, much higher rates of mental health conditions, much higher rates of substance use disorders, particularly during this epidemic of opioids that we're seeing across the country. And they also have higher rates of chronic conditions like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes.
And tuberculosis among inmates and hepatitis, HIV, they're all much higher than the general population.
Yes, absolutely. The rates of infectious disease in jails and prison are a huge problem. And it's becoming an even murkier situation, particularly for illnesses like hepatitis C, where we now have wonderful treatments that can eradicate the disease. Unfortunately, they're very expensive, and county and state governments don't want to pay for those medications while someone is incarcerated. And so often individuals who have a now treatable condition end up not receiving treatment.
If these problems are not addressed while people are behind bars, what happens when they get out?
Accessing health care after someone leaves jail or prison is very challenging. With the advent of the Affordable Care Act and with Healthy Michigan in the state of Michigan, people coming out of prison are now getting enrolled in health insurance. But whether that's actually translating to making an appointment and seeing a physician and getting some of these issues addressed is less clear.
So, doctor, we know Medicaid coverage could address a lot of the kind of problems that we've been talking about. Do we know if the states and counties are taking care of these problems?
We know that states and counties are trying their best to get people enrolled in Medicaid. But once someone has health insurance coverage, it's really quite variable on whether they receive assistance in getting connected to the care they need to take care of these issues.
Why do you think it's important that we as a society and as a country change this exclusion, the Medicaid inmate exclusion policy that dates back all these decades?
Individuals who are involved in the justice system are by far some of the sickest patients that we take care of. And right now, because they're unable to access their Medicaid benefits while they're incarcerated, they're both receiving suboptimal care and they're not receiving appropriate services to transition them to healthcare in the community. So first of all, the repealing the Medicaid exclusion would improve health for this population. It would also dramatically lower the costs that counties and states are paying for this healthcare. And third, we have some evidence that getting appropriate health care to these individuals can lower their likelihood of ending up in prison or jail again.
So the recidivism question comes in.
Absolutely.
There was a recent investigation that you may have heard about, Dr. Winkleman. It was done by Detroit television station WDIV about an inmate in the Macomb County Jail. She was serving a 2-week sentence for driving on a suspended license, 8 months pregnant, and she told jail staff several times she was having labor pains. She claims jail staff called her a liar and, in her words, told her to knock my crap off or they could put another charge on me. She was finally moved after a couple of days to a cell in the infirmary wing of the jail, but she never got to a hospital. She wound up having her baby on the floor of the cell with no doctor in attendance. And the Macomb County Sheriff says his staff handled the situation properly. What does this story tell us about the kind of health care that inmates are getting in our jails and prisons?
I think this situation raises a couple of key issues. First, we know that women in the justice system are an increasingly common demographic. So many of the unique health conditions and reproductive issues that women have to face are rather new issues that jails and prisons are having to deal with. Because they're unable to use their Medicaid benefits while they're in prison or jail, they often lack the appropriate care that they need. There was a report within the last couple of years that showed that Medicaid pays for about 50% of the births in the United States. You can imagine that having that benefit removed while you're incarcerated can really impact the care you receive while you're pregnant.
There are those who will ask this question, why should Medicaid be available to people who have committed a crime? I mean, if it's a benefit, why should they keep it when they've lost other privileges?
I hear that question a lot. And the answer is that whether an individual has health insurance or not, they're able to access expensive health care services like the emergency department, like the hospital. My view is that using health care dollars in a smart way through Medicaid can improve the health of these individuals, can reduce the reliance on expensive health care services, and is just a more humane way to help people get back on their feet, back into an employment, and become contributing members of our communities.
So your voice is among those calling for repealing this Medicaid inmate exclusion policies and having states and counties seek additional federal matching funds for inmate health care. But this comes at a time when the Trump administration is all about shifting that kind of spending to the states and repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. How would your proposal square with the realities of Washington under President Trump?
Here is a policy change that both Republicans and Democrats could agree with. And the reason I say that is because this is a policy that could potentially expand health coverage options to a vulnerable population that traditionally has received inadequate care, while at the same time giving states the flexibility that they want in addressing the important public health issues in their state or in their county. Removing this policy would allow states to use Medicaid dollars in a way that they see fit. And if they believe that this is a smart investment, they would be able to do that.
Is there anything afoot that you're aware of on Capitol Hill right now to repeal this Medicaid exclusion policy?
There have been, just in the last couple of weeks, our article published on The Conversation calls by the National Association of Counties to repeal this piece of legislation. There has been a New York Times editorial. So certainly there are calls mounting. Senator Franken from Minnesota has been interested in at least repealing the Medicaid exclusion for individuals who are pretrial, who have not been convicted of a crime, and were simply too poor to pay their bail and make their way out of jail.
Yes, we mentioned that at the beginning, but it's worth mentioning. This applies to people who are just in pretrial detention, who are facing charges who have not been convicted.
That's right. And not often, but sometimes people can even be sitting in jail for several months awaiting trial. And so you have an individual who's poor, unable to post their $10 bail, sits in jail for 3 months, doesn't get the mental health treatment they need, decompensates, and then has their charges dropped 3 months later. They leave left jail without receiving appropriate treatment, enter the community, and then commit another crime because they, you know, didn't have access to the services that they needed.
Well, much to think about, and you will find Dr. Winkleman's piece on inmates being excluded from Medicaid by going to theconversation.com. Dr. Tyler Winkleman is a physician and a researcher with the University of Michigan. Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you missed any part of today's show, it is very easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast, and you'll find the link. It's a mighty tall order, maintaining navigation channels throughout the Great Lakes all winter long. And that mission is fulfilled by a mighty ship, the Mackinac. She's the only heavy icebreaker the U.S. Coast Guard has on the Great Lakes. Here with us is the commanding officer of the USCG cutter Mackinac, Commander Vasilios Tasikas. Exactly what is your task aboard the Mackinac?
The economic viability of the Great Lakes depends on the many commodities that are moved and transported by ships. And so, as we know, the Great Lakes has a formidable winter season that not only brings the cold and the snow, but brings a lot of ice. And that could be a formidable element that brings maritime transportation to a dead stop. So one of the fundamental reasons we break ice is to get and maintain shipping channels. So we're a specially designed ship with massive power to keep those shipping lanes open.
When we talk about specially designed with massive power, what kind of power is behind the Mackinac, and how do you actually break up the ice? What's the process?
Our length overall is 240 feet. We displace about 3,600 tons, and the power is about 9,000 horsepower. So I would just say the way the ship breaks ice is obviously we have massive power, and so when we hit the ice, that impact causes the ice to shatter and create some radial cracking. But it really is the weight of the ship that does most of the damage. As we move forward in the ice, the bow kind of slides up on the ice, and the ice is pushed down under the ship, causing kind of a bend in that ice plate. And when the ship continues on the ice, it crushes under the weight of the ship and causes the plate ice to break up into small pieces.
So she's just punching her way through.
She's punching and riding on top and breaking and crushing and smashing, yes, all the things, all the above.
I've got to wonder, for those of you who are on the Mackinac while this is going on, this is probably not what we might call a smooth ride.
You know, it's an experience like no other, I can assure you. I mean, as the ship passes through that pressurized ice, it causes violent vibrations. It really does shake the entire ship as the ice kind of grinds against the hull. And there is a deafening, reverberating sound throughout the ship. And it can take a toll on the crew, and it can be quite taxing at times, yes.
And it's not just for a few minutes at a time then, because if you're plowing your way down there, this has got to be a pretty incessant pounding of noise and vibration.
Yes, it is. And we usually start breaking ice right at sunrise, and we continue on through sunset. And if I'm doing an active live escort or convoy, I'll continue well into the night. So it's an all-day affair, everyday affair for days at a time.
Have you ever encountered ice, Commander, that's been too thick for the Mackinac to break through?
There's nothing really too thick for the Mackinac. I mean, we're designed to break about 3 feet, up to 3 feet continuously without any problem. If there's anything higher than that or thicker than that, and I have encountered it, we just back up and ram through it a couple times, and we'll get through it eventually. So I've seen up to maybe 6, 8 feet of ice ridges, and if we kind of hit it hard, we'll just back up and it'll take a couple swipes at it, and we'll get through one way or the other.
Now, if I'm correct, this is your third winter commanding the Mackinac?
It's my third winter on the Mackinac as commanding officer. It's my eighth winter up on the Great Lakes. I've been in and out of the Great Lakes since 2003 as an operator, so I have the fortune of commanding Mackinac the last 3 years.
And how has the ice in this winter been for you and the crew compared to your previous winters?
Well, like last year, it's well below the seasonal average, nothing like the winters of 2 and even 3 years ago. I think the lake water temperatures going into the winter were above average, and the average air temperatures this winter, especially November and this last month of February, were above average. So, but that, you know, Cindy, that can be a little bit deceiving because ice, especially the thick ice in the Great Lakes, tends to accumulate in bays and ports and choke points like the St. Mary's River and the Straits of Mackinac, basically all the places where ships want to go and they want to get to. So So when it comes to the demand of ice breaking, there's still needs in a relatively low ice breaking year.
I've kind of wondered, have you ever had to do some rescues?
During the ice breaking season, the biggest concern is when a ship kind of gets into shifting plate ice in a small, tight channel. So a few years ago, we had a situation where a Laker ship was coming up the channel and got into late night ice that shifted, and she got stuck in that ice, but it was shifting towards shoal water. So we made kind of a late night grab to relieve her within yards, maybe of a couple hundred yards away from shoal water. So there are times where it gets pretty dangerous, and we're fortunate to be there and have the capability to make sure that ship didn't run aground.
What does the Mackinac do in the summer months?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we are an icebreaker, but we have multi-mission capabilities, which was a great design feature. So during the other times of the year, we work and service buoys, those floating aids of navigation on the Great Lakes. We also conduct maritime law enforcement and, of course, search and rescue.
What drew you to the U.S. Coast Guard over the other branches of military service?
I do like its peacetime mission. I always was kind of attracted to serving in the military. I do like the water, and I think I just like the fact that the Coast Guard has these kind of peacetime missions year-round, and so I've enjoyed it. I didn't seek out to be an ice-breaking captain, but once I got a chance to do it, kind of hooked, and I've loved it ever since.
Are you from the Great Lakes?
Believe it or not, I grew up in Rochester, New York, and I went to school in Buffalo, University of Buffalo. So I joined the Coast Guard kind of hoping for a warm port assignment, but I've kind of it's by accident that I've had become a Great Lakes sailor, yes.
Well, he is the commander of the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Mackinac, the only heavy icebreaker on the Great Lakes right now. And we want to thank you so much, Commander Vasilios Tasikas. Thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Well, thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.